Hey, Duke Batters, welcome to Bad Boy Running Podcast. And I've just had this interview with Pete, our next guest. Really, really interesting. We go into a few areas I hadn't expected us to talk about. We obviously talk about Badwater and his unexpected first win, and but actually how his second win with the course record, he went into it having had a fairly disastrous year because of he was unaware of his diet was letting him down. We also talk about how his approach to ultra running is almost against the grain of what is being lent on more by runners these days. And he's still a proponent of doing very long runs and how he's integrated those into his lifestyle, given that he's got a full-time job, and also how why he thinks he's been successful at that and what you need to do if that is your approach to make sure you are actually recovering and it's not impacting on the rest of your training, but also on injuries. And then we talk about his TranCon record, 42 days, an absolutely incredible time, and how he completely balls up his strategy and had to take a day off in the middle of it, and it almost didn't come together. So take it away, Nick.
They're bad, they're boys, and occasionally they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller. Come back. Baby, come back.
Bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around, but that doesn't mean that you have to leave town.
So, Duke Batters, our next guest. Actually, he'd been on our radar for a long time because of his amazing feats, but then we were lucky enough to he was booked for the stage at the Run Show Boston, and it was such a good session. We had to have him take that opportunity to then blackmail him onto our own podcast. So, welcome to the. Well, if you don't know Pete, he's run Badwater several times. He's won it twice. He's also got the record, an unbelievable record for Trans America, which is just incredible. So welcome to the podcast, the wonderful Pete Kosanek.
Thanks for having me, David.
There's more of a cheer normally when Jody's here as well. We get the surround sound cheer. How was the running show for you? Because we're used to it more in the UK, that kind of format of business meets consumer, but it, from my understanding, actually it tends to be more business to business, the American trade fair. So what was your take on it?
I loved it. It was kind of fun because I'd been to Boston a couple of times the last couple of years, really all because of Dave McGilvery. I went 2 years ago to do what we call the night run, where Dave runs Boston. He's been the race director for longer than I've been alive, I think.
Yeah.
And so we would do the night run. So he's, always the last finisher of the Boston. And then this last year I was going to try to do the double, where I competed in Boston Marathon and then took an Uber back to the start, but I was too cold. And I said, no, there's no way I'm going to be able to make it. So it was kind of fun to come back, a third time in the last few years, getting to see some of that Boston running community that I'd kind of grown familiar with, but then also just seeing and meet seeing some people I'd met before, and also just getting to meet people that I knew from afar and not having met. So it was just a really cool event to just it running's always a small world, so it was the social aspect was great.
Yeah, it's really nice when you get to see people like Corey meet Scott and Scott meet yourself, and we've got no sense of who knows each other and who doesn't, because it's so far removed. I didn't realize that about the Boston Marathon then. So he runs the exact route, is that the night before?
Yeah, so Dave once the race is all over, he's always gone back to the start, and usually he has maybe a dozen or so friends. That now the year I did it with him, it was a pretty big group, just because I think it was the 50th time that Dave had done Boston. So yeah, it was pretty cool to be a part of that. And he we had these really cool like giant custom medals that were made and everything. So it was a really good time.
And how long does that normally take? Do people stopping? Is there any nutrition on the route? Is there anyone out, or is it quite a weird experience?
Yeah. We had kind of a little low frills, like crew that followed and would kind of, we'd stop for, you know, a few seconds here or maybe a couple minutes here and there. I think Dave, you know, he still cranks out sub 5 hour marathon. So it wasn't, you know, it was pretty good pace.
Because I went to the November Project, which is a free fitness community on the Friday before the show. And they'd said about a different one as well. Maybe it is the same, but they'd changed the wording of it. I think it's called like the not sob, or the 26.2 marathon or something like that. Well, they do it the day before as well. But
oh yeah,
that's different, I guess, is it?
There's also the people that bike it the night before, I think. Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of crazy stuff. I know, and I'm, you know, as an ultra runner, I know a lot of people that do. They run from the finish to the start the morning of, and then they race back, and that's kind of like an FKT in itself.
Because we've got that for London. We have the like a backwards medal that it's.
Oh yeah.
But I've never got a sense. I wasn't sure whether that would happen in America in the same way in the UK, just because my assumption would be that security would be tighter in America, or that the law enforcement would be a bit more strict within like keeping the streets clean or security or those things. And
yeah, probably.
Well, let's go back to, because in terms of your running, a lot of American runners we chat to have come through the collegiate system, whereas actually you didn't really take that route.
No, I was kind of like I would consider myself more of a hobby jogger, casual runner in high school, and then didn't really find much interest in, and yeah, I mean, I guess I always kind of found interest in running, but I just didn't really find any interest in like competition really until I found, you know, ultra marathons, I would say.
Was that because you weren't, 20s. Would you say it's because you weren't competitive or you weren't enjoying the process?
I think I just never really knew how to run a marathon. Like I love doing road marathons, and then I just never really knew how to train properly for them. So then it almost took like having to step up to like a longer distance and really kind of learn kind of the hard way how to be a decent runner. And then I did come back to like road marathons here and there and had, you know, ran them a lot better and smarter than I did before. So I think it was almost just like I never do anything the easy way. So I think just like with running is no different. It was like I was too stubborn to like really reach out to people about how to train correctly, and then I kind of just had to stumble across it through finding ultra marathons.
And is that, did you think that's because there was more information available for ultra runners, or was it because you come in contact more with the community and therefore share tips amongst individuals?
Yeah, I think it's honestly what you mentioned second was, I got into triathlons a little bit. You know, I found out pretty quickly I wasn't really interested in those. But yeah, I think maybe part of the reason why I got more into ultra marathons was just because of, you know, I'd see the same people at, you know, each race. Whereas, you know, if it's like a big city marathon, you don't really know that many people you're running with. And so then, you know, just by default, I was like sharing ideas with other runners because I would, you know, run into them at, you know, two or three times, you know, a month sometimes if I was doing a bunch of different races. And so, yeah, I think it was really, that was kind of what locked me into ultra running, was just that kind of, maybe not like everyday type of community, but just like the same kind of group of people that you kind of feel like you're a part of.
When was that, out of interest? What kind of year are we talking?
I'd say 2011 was kind of the year that I kind of got all in on ultras. I went and did my first ultra, and then I also did my first 100 miler that same year too. So I kind of just dove in the deep end right away.
Interesting. And which seems more normal now, but back then was, I mean, that's quite an acceleration. Like, how many ultras would you say you did that first year?
I probably did probably four or five, I would say. Okay. It was, Yeah, back then, like the 100 mile was a very much like the 200 miler is today. It was kind of there really weren't any, 100 milers with more than a few dozen people usually, and there weren't that many. It was maybe one a weekend in the U.S. Now there's probably at least 400 or 500s every weekend to choose from.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many really compared, because we do have 200s now in the UK. There are quite a few hundreds, but there still seem to be, the organizers. And I think almost there's a lack of confidence or from race organizers of, or maybe there's lack of interest for race organizers themselves of thinking, actually, do I want to take on something? Because it's a lot of work for them as well. And you don't necessarily make more money or actually get like a better experience from the athlete, because it's just so many more provisions. So first ultra then, what was it?
First one I ever did, it was called Brew to Brew. Is a just like a 44 mile point to point race near in Kansas City. And you started at a brewery and you ended at a brewery in another town. And it was really like a 10 leg relay race. And you could split the legs up if you wanted to have two runners, you wanted three runners, four runners, or you could do the solo division, which is what I did, because I had a few friends that kind of just like dared me into it one night. And so I signed up as a solo runner. And I like, it's just kind of funny to think back on, because it's like, I was like freaking out over a 44 mile ultra, which I'm sure a lot of people, maybe even people listening would freak out on. But now to me, it's like, it's just, it's not easy. It's never easy to do that distance, but it's just a totally different state of mind now to me, as far as like the how long you're running for compared to some of the other endeavors I've taken on.
And was there money on that bet, and then how soon before the race was that made?
I'm sure it was all alcohol related bet. So I got third place overall. I think I started out like in 15th, 20th place, and then like I just moved my way up. And it was kind of a cool experience, because I didn't really, and I still never have huge expectations for each race, but back then it was like I just didn't even know what my body was capable of, because I'd never run close to that far in my life.
Why did your friends challenge you? Is that because they had an inkling that you were a good runner, because they thought you were a terrible runner, or because you were kind of sucker for challenges?
I think it was a little bit of both. I think it was they knew that I was an easy target for peer pressure. And then I think maybe it was like three ways. It was they knew that I loved to do like long runs of, marathon distances. Deep inside me, I think I also like aspired to go do something, even more challenging mentally. Mm. And then I think just being open to peer pressure, like I still am today, was like the third bullet in that one.
So did it basically backfire a little bit then, the fact that you did so well?
No, they were happy for me. I think we would always try to like challenge each other to do whatever it was, whether it was anything athletic or if it was like career related or anything else. We'd always like challenge each other, to go do it and not be scared to do it.
And and in terms of preparation, kind of how much training have you done for that one?
I think I actually trained pretty well. I was pretty smart, because I would, I was scared of the 44 mile distance. So I think I did do, at least one run of over a marathon, but I had it's kind of funny, because those were the days when I had a bad knee, and like you would think like 100,000 miles, almost 100,000 miles on foot later, my knees would be worse, but they're actually better, I think, today than they were then. So I always like had to pick and choose like how many days I would run a week. And I think, I was only training maybe 3 or 4 days a week, but I was just,
What was that, do you think? Was that ITB or something else?
Yeah. It was just, I think it's because when I used to do road marathons, and this is where I didn't really know how to train correctly. And I think for every person, there's a different way to train correctly. But for me, I was like going out at like marathon goal pace every day for like 8 to 12 miles, which now, you know, I realize that's kind of a little bit too much as far as pace. And so I think that's why I always had knee issues back then.
Oh, interesting. So actually, there almost was a route where you may have retired from running and just thought, these distances are right for me.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't even break 3 hours in a marathon. And so I gave up on road marathons and said, I'll just do ultras and see how that goes. And then I came back, you know, I'll never be as fast as like the Olympics, like marathoners for the US, but no, I came back and ran, you know, high 230s, not really even training for the marathon specifically. So I think there are a lot of ways to train, you know, outside the box,
yeah.
You know, just this, even when it comes to road marathons, I think, if you have, you know, an extremely high amount of endurance and durability in your legs, you can, you know, rip off some PRs at shorter distances too, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that people underestimate how much running economy comes into it. And actually, yeah, all of my fast times at short distances have been when I've been training for the ultra marathons, just because you're running so much more. So with, interesting. And out of interest, so were you following things like marathon training plans at that time when you were going for your sub-3? But they were surely everywhere, right? Every email you got from the race organizers or...
Yeah, no, they were. And I think, I think a lot of it for me, you know, I did look at some like that were, you know, in the popular running books back in the day. But I think for me, it was just like, I was just too stubborn to run slow. Like I always felt like every day I ran, I had to like hold, you know, I couldn't have anything, you know, above 7XX per mile.
Yeah.
And things like that, you know, or probably, you know, nothing above 5 minutes per kilometer. And so I think it was just like, I think it was just an element of stubbornness. But then when it came to ultra marathons, like when you want to go further, you got to go slower. Like you can't, there's no like saying, I'm just going to go rattle off, you know, a 50 mile training run at a 6:30 pace because you're just going to burn out. You know, that's, you know, you might be able to do it once, but you're not going to be able to go out and do it, you know, weekend after weekend after weekend. And so I think that was the kind of the beauty of, the ultra marathons for me, was it kind of gave me an excuse to, and even, you know, running across the US, like there were times where if there was a big hill, you know, I'm like, man, I'm running like over 70 miles a day. I think I have an excuse, you know, to walk for a few minutes and things like that. So I think ultra marathons ultimately kind of like put my mind at ease a little bit as far as like, just, you know, how you train for it, because you have to really be smart and think, you know, play the long game, like literally and figuratively, yeah, when it comes to how to train right.
What is that voice though? Because whenever I've trained for tough races, I've always done what I think is strategically the right thing to do, whether, you know, in training I've trained what I think is going to help me the most, whereas it almost sounds as if there is a voice in your head. Is it driven by how you think others see you? Is it driven by your own kind of ego, or what do you think it is that is causing you to do something that you probably know is actually not the right thing for you?
I think what I you know, because this was pre-Strava, and I, you know, honestly, I never even got a GPS watch until I think 2016, but I think a lot of it for me at the time was, you know, the thing maybe I like most about running, and even like now, is like making progress every day and seeing tangible improvement. And so like when I started running, it was like, you know, 5 days out of seven, I would see tangible progress each day. Some days I maybe not wouldn't, but maybe I just wasn't like feeling the best that day. And so I think that was my problem, was like, I didn't understand why I would have an off day, or I felt like if I had an off day, I was like going backwards in training, when really it was just, I was exhausted or burnt out. And so I think it was just like a very internal ego thing at the start. And then I think over the years with things like Strava and like sharing all of your runs with people, sometimes like maybe not intentionally, but like I would get a little bit over anxious if I knew I could like rattle off a really fast, like last 20 miles of a 50 mile training run. And so I think that's the second hurdle I've had to deal with personally is getting over the, you know, Strava wars and things like that. Cause it's good, I think, mentally to, you know, as a community to share your stuff with your friends on there. But I think sometimes also it gets a little too competitive, especially with, you know, some of the segment stuff and things like that. So I think, you know, I finally got over that hurdle maybe a year or two ago. But I think for a while that was one thing I also struggled with from a
wow
perspective.
So even like, so you'd won Badwater even with this pressure on you actually to push yourself out of good training methodology.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think it's, and sometimes I think it's also not just pace, but it's also like miles, and you want to like, sometimes it's almost like you feel like you're like letting down a friend of yours if you're, you know, they could be on the other side of the world, and if you're not putting in like the week you want. So I think that's the other thing that maybe that was like the bigger one for me is like volume, because there was a time where I was doing, you know, well over 100 miles every week, sometimes, you know, multiple 200 mile weeks in a month. And it, you can do that for a little while, but it's not, I don't think it's very sustainable over a long period.
So in your head, you're thinking, you know, if I don't run 200, Mustafa's going to, he's going to be so disappointed in this training block I've done.
Yep, exactly. Or yeah, someone will start asking, you know, what's wrong? Why didn't you run 200 miles this week?
Wow.
So it's good and bad, I think.
Yeah, I guess that we feed the beast that then, you know, we start the stones rolling, don't we? And that becomes its own momentum. So then that first 100, did you know you had talent then? Did that go well?
No, I that was really hard. I think I underestimated, because it was a trail race in Southeast Missouri in the Ozarks. And it was, I wouldn't consider it a very technical trail race, but it was in November, and it was like over 4 inches of like 4 inches of leaves over the entire course. And so all you hear the whole race is your legs shuffling through leaves.
Wow.
And there's rocks underneath the leaves. And so you're just like, it's like searching, like it's like running in, you know, in the ocean, and you can't see the bottom. And so you just have to like feel with your feet. And so it was just way outside my comfort zone. And I, even to this day, I wouldn't really consider myself a very good trail runner, just because I think I've put so many road miles on my legs that I just don't bend certain ways. And so that was very eye opening. I think it took me it was over 28 hours. And, you know, it was like double, you know, I've shaved off over 50% of that time, you know, on a much faster course, obviously, running a 14 hour, but so it's, you know, 28 hours, you know, it's respectful to always finish a 100 miler, but was not a very good time at all.
Yeah, but I've never heard of a trail being technical because of leaves. That's amazing. It's something you just wouldn't consider.
Yep.
any advice for if you suddenly turn down a trail and you can't see anything, is there a good technique?
I don't think so. I think it's, you want to get your feet higher up, but when you're doing 100 miles and your legs are getting dead, it's like you can't pick your feet up very much. And that's why I think I messed up my knee pretty bad that race. I felt like I had a golf ball behind my right knee for like 3 weeks. It was so bad.
Oh God. So when did you start? Cause that almost sort of put me off, I think. And is that common to just do 100 milers in completely different areas to where you kind of live and train?
I think it just comes down to, you know, a lot of people, I would say most people probably stick close to home for their, you know, hundreds, but, you know, I just love like trying new things. And there for a while I didn't, and I think I got kind of burnt out on ultras by kind of doing the same races, same type of races every year. And so now I've kind of gotten back to where I think, you know, I'm really testing myself, you know, almost half the time I'm testing myself in things I wouldn't consider me good at. But I think it just makes for a better all around experience to really try, because that's what I think is probably one of my 100 favorite things of ultra running is, but near the top of that 100 is just the variety of different races that you can do in ultra marathons, because there's really, it's limited in rules. So, you know, there's so many different formats, whether it's, you know, a point to point race, a loop race, a backyard ultra, which scares the crap out of me, fixed time race, you know, there's just, and then it can be, you know, literally any distance. So I think that's what intrigues me so much about the sport, is it's like, you could do the sport for, you know, from the time you're 20 to the time you're 90 years old and still barely feel like you scratched the surface.
What scares you about the backyards?
I think because I'd rather compete with myself. And so for that, and I guess, you know, in any race, you're competing against other people, but I just feel like in a normal, you know, and even fixed time races have kind of messed with me. So, you know, a fixed distance race, obviously, is most people are familiar with, where, you know, you cover 26.2 miles for a marathon or 100 miles for a 100 miler. The fixed time races, I think, are very mentally challenging, but though that's where you run the most miles you can in a fixed amount of time. So 24 hours, 12 hours, 6 hours, what have you. But then the backyard race is kind of like a mixture of both, where you're running, you know, a loop of about 4.167 miles every hour. You have to start on the hour every hour. And I think just the sleep deprivation and then the amount of hatred I would have for the other competitors after, you know, you're, because they go, you know, they go up to like, I don't know, 4 or 5 days now. And so you're out there for 5 days without sleeping for more than like, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes if you're lucky, if you have a really good lap. But then I just wonder, you know, it's like, yeah, you would just, it just, I don't think I would have the, you know, I think I'm pretty mentally strong in some ways, but that's a race where I just don't think I would have the mental fortitude to do.
I just think it's the boredom. I'd just be so, I don't think I'd ever have a big enough why, because it's such a different challenge focusing on a speed or a distance, as you say. And my why would never be enough, that when I'm even the third loop, I'd be like, I've done this loop already. I'm bored of that. And so let's talk about Badwater then, because when did that become your focus?
I think, you know, kind of early on in ultras, it's funny because I read about Badwater in a magazine when I was like a freshman in college. And, you know, and this was back when I hadn't even done a half marathon yet. And I didn't really have any intention of ever being, you know, like an endurance runner, but I just thought it was kind of one of the coolest stories that I'd ever read. And I can't remember if it was an article. For all I know, maybe it was about Scott Jurek. I can't remember. Or maybe it was another guy that was running Badwater. Maybe it was Mike Wardy. I don't know. But it was in like ESPN. It was in like a magazine that wasn't really a running magazine. It was just a sports magazine in the US, and that I just happened to get. And I think just reading it about it, I was just like so intrigued. And then like fast forward, you know, another, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. And I'm like, getting into ultras, didn't really think about that race, but then I like start hearing more about that race and I'm like, well, that'd be really cool to do someday. And so I applied. Pretty early on, I would say, like, you know, within a year of starting to do ultras, it was on my bucket list. But I never really dreamed I'd ever get in or even win the race. So I thought that was kind of a pretty crazy thing.
Cause like, what would you say the main steps you took from being a reasonable ultra runner to winning Badwater, where would you say that your big improvements were, and how did you change your approach for that race?
Yeah, you know, I think I got into that race about 3 years into ultras in 2014 for the first time, and going out there and doing the race, you know, I think I may have finished 14th place maybe, so I did pretty good, but it wasn't like I knew I had something better to provide. And, you know,
why
I
did
think
you,
I credit
like
a
what
lot.
Told you that?
Oh, just because of the last, you know, I would say the last after mile, you know, 75, 80, I just couldn't keep anything down. So I was like, about the only calories I could get was like putting a Jolly Rancher in the side of my mouth and just like letting it melt. And then, you know, nibbling off a little bit of beef jerky here and there. But yeah, I think it was just, and, you know, I never really thought, you know, if I came back the next year, I'd win the race. But I kind of had like this approach that, you know, like, well, I'll come back next year and I'll place at least top 10, maybe top five. And then, you know, the next year I'll place top three. And then maybe the year after that, maybe I'll like get first or second place. And so it was kind of like a very long-term plan that I just wanted to keep executing on. And yeah, it just happened sooner than I thought. And actually during that race in 2015, when I got first place, I remember like seeing the, you know, Valmir Nunez, who's a legendary ultra runner from Brazil, who I think had the course record at the time, had come back and wanted to, you know, obviously win the race again. And I remember like seeing his crew vehicle up ahead, and it actually made me like mad because I was dying. And, you know, the last thing I wanted was to like people to think I had to start racing, like to really like stay in this race. Like I was perfectly content with getting second place. You know, that would have been beyond my wildest dreams that year. I would have been ahead of schedule, maybe come back the next year and win the race. But so it was just one of those weird things where you're like, oh crap, now I have to like go win this thing. So yeah, it was just pretty cool experience. And, you know, I think a lot of it was, you know, before I did Badwater, you know, I had moved to Nebraska in 2012. And Nebraska, not really known for, you know, a hot ultra running scene, but, you know, I met some, you know, pretty cool people in Lincoln, Nebraska that I think, you know, really kind of motivated me to like take that next step. And, you know, I kind of felt like it was like a very healthy competition and like kind of feeling a part of like, you know, a running team and everything like that, which, you know, I never really had in the past, really kind of gave me that extra motivation to get faster and, you know, do, you know, really start the year off with some shorter races and really improve my fitness because, you know, I think I had the mental part down for ultras, but I don't think I had, you know, just like the basic level of, you know, healthy, or I don't know, healthy is the right word, you know, really strong fitness to back it up. But I think that's where I kind of got focused on it a little bit more.
And were you doing that speed work amongst still large mileage weeks, or were you reducing it down and just doing fast?
Yeah. During the winter, it was kind of weird. You know, back then I would work a little bit more on my speed during the winter and not as high volume. And I think it was just kind of natural with the way, you know, the racing schedule worked was I would do a lot of shorter distance races in the late winter, early spring. And then I would kind of morph into ultras as the late spring, summer kind of warmed up. And I think that was always a good approach. I tried doing that these last couple of years with mixed results, but that's kind of always been my approach, is like kind of up the mileage of the race as the year kind of progresses.
Which actually is, yeah, this, depending where you are, slightly different route for some people, because you'll find some people actually they do cross country and they do hard slogs during the winter, or they'll kind of get strong and build the base in the winter with the mileage and then get sharper as they come out. Tell us about that battle for first that you mentioned. You suddenly had kind of a hero in front of you. How did that race go down?
It was funny because in that race, I remember I took the lead like early in the race, like 40 miles in. And then I let like at least
from him.
I can't remember. I think it was actually Harvey Lewis and me, because Harvey had won the year before. And so Harvey and I were kind of 1-2 early on. And, you know, I took, because the first 42 miles of that race are all flat. And so that to me felt like my strength was the flats, not necessarily the ups and downs.
Were you comfortable with leading?
It was kind of exciting for me because I thought, wow, like I'm coming into, you know, the mile 42 checkpoint and everyone back home would see me in first place. You know, after I was probably much further back after the first checkpoint at mile 17. And the cool thing about that race is it's very remote and there's really, you know, you only get tracking maybe every 4 to 6 hours because just how, you know, obviously long some of those stretches are. And so, yeah, I just remember taking lead early, but then letting a bunch of people pass me on this big climb and they were just going lightning speed up this 5,000 foot climb. And then I thought, okay, well, that's cool. You know, I was in the lead for a little bit, so maybe I'll just back off a little bit and see if I can like hang on, you know, to where I wanted to be in the race. But then, yeah, it was just kind of a war. That race just about every year is a war of attrition. And I found myself move up to second place and that felt really cool. But then, yeah, just with, and unfortunately Valmir, I think he had an injury. So that was really the reason why he was slowing so much. But took the lead. And then, I remember there seeing a photo in that race where I took a break on the side of the road. Like I was really hurting. I was not feeling good myself. And I just remember there was like I have a photo somewhere of like me in a lawn chair with like a cold towel all over my head. And then like the rest of my crew, we were just all sitting there. Like, you know, we were just drinking a beer, you know, and obviously not drinking beer, but we were just all chilling. Like we're at a tailgate or something. And so I just think that whenever I see that photo, I just laugh because I'm just like, man, like I was not like calm at all mentally, but to see that photo, it looked like we were just hanging out for like 5 minutes and then I got back on the road. And the cool thing about that was maybe three of the biggest Badware legends were all running. It was obviously Harvey early on, Valmir, you know, 100 miles into the race, was a little over 100 miles maybe when I caught him. But then Oswaldo Lopez, another legend, was chasing me towards the end. And so I think just kind of looking back on it, it was kind of a cool experience just based on, you know, who I was up against.
And when you have a moment like that where you sit in a deck chair with a towel on you, how do you know it's the right thing to do? And how do you ensure that you take enough time, but not too much time?
Oh, it's hard. I think normally I'm very stubborn and don't like to, you know, fix things before they become a problem. You know, to a certain degree, I think I was just cooked. And I can't remember if that was before or after I caught the Valmir. Maybe I had just like, maybe even like kind of thrown in the towel on trying to catch him. I can't remember, but yeah, that's just the funny nature of ultras. You go to such crazy places in your mind that, you know, you swear you'll never do it again when you're doing it. And then about 2 minutes after you finish, you're just like, oh, that was the best thing ever. Kind of reminds me of when I was a kid, you know, I was terrified of roller coasters, but I'd be like in line for the roller coaster thinking about how this was the dumbest thing I ever did. And then, you know, once you got done, once you get off, you're just like, wow, that was awesome. I'm not sure if I'll do it again quite yet, but I'm really glad I did it, type of feeling.
And you mentioned how the first year you'd had this issue with your nutrition. What did you change or how did you fix that so that the year you won, it wasn't a big issue?
I think, you know, a lot of it was just part of it, probably just efficiency with higher mileage training. And then I think part of it also was just, I think there's, you know, I tell a lot of people more, you know, probably half the reason I run as many miles as I do in training is not necessarily to get that extra fitness, but to train my stomach. Cause like, you know, when you're out doing like a 40, 50 mile training run, you know, you have to eat. Like you're not going to be able to do it without eating at least, you know, probably a couple thousand calories while you're doing it. And so I think it's really training and really mapping out nutrition and then having simulation through training, just seeing what does work and what doesn't work. I think sometimes, you know, you you look at what something might have worked in one race and then you swear by it in every race after that. And sometimes that's not always like going to be the magic elixir. I think for me, it was like chili. Mm. It was like I had chili one time at a 100-mile race that kind of saved me from death. But then like every race after that, I thought, oh yeah, I have to eat chili at mile, 62, because that's where I ate it during
like a meat chili.
I don't know if it did or not, but maybe it did. I can't remember,
but a kind of, because just chili as in like a Mexican meat, bolognese style dish.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It's hard to take on a training run, right?
Yeah.
and because I think some people do take nutrition on their training runs, but it tends to be more of a top up when you need, rather than, would you fuel as aggressively as when you race on your long training runs then?
Yeah, probably not. I think that's the other thing, is just, I think race experience goes a long ways too, because you don't get, with 100 mile plus races, mm. you just don't get a whole lot of at bats. And so I think obviously there, you don't want to be, I don't know, I have a pretty ambitious year I'm hoping to do this year, but I'm not too concerned about, the rate at which I'm running this year. But I think that's always the catch 22, I think, is, how often do you do an ultra? Because I think, if you, most people who do their first 100 miler, it's not as successful as they would like it to be, or anywhere near it usually. And so I think just getting that experience and those at-bats really helps with, I don't know if some of it boils down to confidence, or if some of it boils down to just the muscle memory of, being able to get those calories down. But I think that's what I've found, was just, it just took, about 400 or 500 plus mile races before I kind of figured it out.
And you mentioned about, you do some very long runs, and actually it seems that almost the tide's turning against that approach to ultras. You've seen Kim O'Heron saying she doesn't do anything more than kind of 2 hours, 14, 16 miles. And even people that are doing long training blocks at a weekend are now potentially splitting it into four sessions, or one long run and one day and splitting the next day. You've kind of stuck with these very long training runs still. Like how do you approach that, and how do you fit that into your training to make sure that you can handle it, and that actually it's not then reducing the impact of your ability to train afterwards?
Yeah. I think it's just, I tend to take a lot of off days. I do admire people that do run streaks, but I think that's the big thing for me, is just having, a window of say, 36 hours or more, hopefully at least once a week to really get back to neutral, I think has always kind of been my big thing. But also I think, when I do, I do a lot of like the really long training runs, I'm not really pushing it that hard. I usually, so I think that's the other part of it, is, I think for me personally, if I do too many, shorter distance runs, and, short, but meaning by shorter, meaning maybe under 20 miles, I always fear that I'm going to injure myself by pushing it too hard at some point. So I think for me, actually, like, and I think everyone's different, I think for me personally, it's, doing a 40 mile training run at like, a 9 minute pace, to me feels like less impact on my body than if I was doing say 20 miles at a 7 minute pace, for example. So I think that's the other part, is, on the really uber long training runs, I usually don't, and I fuel quite a bit too. I think if you under fuel, you're also susceptible to injury as well.
Mm. Yeah. And I think even marathon runners, we probably under fuel on a marathon, our long runs there, kind of take one for if you get tired or you need it. So then with the second Badwater, was the second Badwater win, was that a very different experience in your prep going in and actually on finishing?
Yeah, absolutely. It was kind of a weird year for me because I didn't really, in 2015 when I, finished first at Badwater, I had done a much more traditional, like, marathon, 40 miler, 50 mile, that type of buildup. In 2016 though, I found out when I tried donating blood at work that I was not just anemic, but extremely anemic. And so like that was in the end of March. And Badwater's was in I think early mid July. So I had, like a 3.5 months to figure out how to get some more blood in my veins.
Is that why you're having all that chili just to get extra?
Oh, right. Yeah.
Extra platelet coming in.
I think that was my problem then is I don't try to eat a lot of meat, but I didn't eat any meat at that time. But then I also wasn't very smart about getting, iron through different foods or supplements. And so I was just, I didn't even know that much about iron, to be honest. And it was so bad that like I tried doing that. Of course, a week later, I go down to Kansas City and try to do that brew to brew race. The first one I did, for the I think this at this point, it would have been like the sixth time I did the race. And I got 10 miles in and I was, the year before I had just crushed that race. I was 10 miles in and I could barely lift my legs up. And so I dropped, my legs were just so tight because they were just, the anemia was just, I had no energy. Leading up to Badwater that year, it was a very different experience. I did Western States, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks, maybe 3 weeks before Badwater. Did okay, but didn't really feel that good about it. And I remember texting my friend Chuck, who was going to crew me at Badwater that year, and just he's like, "So you thinking course record this year, right?" And I'm like, and I meant every word I said to him. I said, "No, I just want to finish." Like I'm usually pretty bold about my predictions for a race, but that year I was just like, "Let's just get to the finish line." And I don't know, it was just I hadn't really raced that much. I did Western States, which was obviously a trail race. I think I got like 25th or so in that race, so not terrible, but not like as good as I would have hoped. But no, I just getting back out to Badwater, I don't know if it was all the downhill training I got through doing Western States or what, but I just felt so good. And I just remember, maybe not even 100, maybe like 80 miles into that race, telling my friend Kyle, like, if someone comes up and tries to pass me in this race, I'm going to take the lead right back because I feel like $1 million. And yeah, it was probably one of the, I don't know why it was such a good race, but it was, and I felt so good. And really in that race, I just remember thinking, when I knew the course record was within reach, I know that the last 13 miles is all uphill and it's mostly a hike anyway. So I told my friend Kyle, I was like, the finish line is Lone Pine, which is 13 miles below the finish line. And that was just how I had to think of it psychologically, was I just had to crush that flat section from Darwin all the way to Lone Pine as quickly as I could, and then deal with the consequences of hiking up to Mount Whitney afterwards. So yeah, it was just a very different feeling at that race. It was very much like, I went in with much less confidence than the year before, but I think I kind of like found myself by, about halfway into that race, I just felt like I couldn't do anything wrong.
Which you wouldn't expect given, Western States 3-4 is certainly not enough time to recover. Do you think the effects of understanding iron deficiency you'd managed to turn it around and actually you had a stronger body than you'd expected?
Yeah. And I don't know if it was just, I was so used to running like on such low iron that like once I did have like my iron levels back up, I just felt like a superhuman or what. And I don't know. And well, that's the thing I tell some people is in ultras, you know, mixing up the races, you know, Western States, Badwater, obviously two very different types of races, one being trail, one being all road. I think you can kind of get away with stuff like that when you're mixing up the terrains, mixing up the distances with your races. So, you know, I try not to do I try not to do multiple races of the same, you know, same type and distance.
Same muscle group almost.
Yeah, same muscle group, exactly. So, and I think also just being out at Western States, it was like, I think it was a really good heat training session because it was pretty hot that year, if I remember right. And I guess I just kind of crammed all my heat training all into one weekend, I guess.
And with the heat and the intensity of it, are there some things you've done that you think you do better than others? Any technical tips on either food, nutrition, crew, kit?
Yeah, I think any race that's, I feel like I do pretty good on loop races, like, you know, a fixed time race. If I show up in good shape, that I, you know, obviously you can't fake fitness, but I think just because I'm I like to think I come very, very prepared for the race. So like, you know, I have everything kind of mapped out hour by hour, you know, what I'm going to take so that, you know, I'm not just kind of wheeling and dealing. Cause you know, sometimes if you show up to a race and you don't really have like a plan and you just have a bunch of different stuff that you eat, you're just going to eat the things that you crave the most, but they may not be what your body needs. So I think that's always been one of my strengths is getting a good variety of calories and nutrients when I do those types of races.
How do your nutrients come? Because most calories aren't nutrients really when you think about what people typically take.
Yeah, I mean, I mix it up a lot. I do a little bit of everything. I try not to go too. I try to stay away from like, I don't know. Like I always say that like for myself, if I try to save the really sugary stuff for the final push, whether it's, you know, a 100-mile race or a 6-day race. If you throw too much sugar at your body too soon, you're gonna have stomach issues. I think that's always at least been my experience. Like, you know, you burn the slower burning calories early, burn the oil, save the, you know, lighter fluid and, you know, that type of stuff for the finish kick. But I think just also from like an efficiency standpoint, you know, when I ran across the US, I don't think I ever really, while I was out on the road, I never really stopped like without moving. Like, you know, even when my crew was out there, I would continue moving forward, really at every second, I think. And that's the thing in ultras, just, it's not necessarily a speed race, it's an efficiency race. And so I think just finding how to be efficient and, you know, always moving forward is, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but it's so true. I think, you know, a lot of people, myself included, you know, you sit down for a long break and it just takes that much longer, you know, to warm the muscles back up or even want to find the desire to start running again. And so I think just if you always, you know, safety first, you know, in ultra running, it's, you know, efficiency first.
I guess never give yourself that opportunity to not get started again. Well then Transcon then, because that's a massive difference to Badwater, all in one to actually multi-day. And even logistically, given that you have a full-time job, being able to actually take that time off. So was the record always the plan?
Yep. It really was something I found early in ultra running that I wanted to do, not for the record, but just to do maybe like, you know, 30 years later when I was maybe retired from work and I could just go do it at a casual pace, see the country and things like that. But yeah, no, it was just, I think after placing first at Badwater in 2015, I think that was where it kind of became something I thought, well, maybe I should like consider going for it. Like I didn't really have a ton of goals in ultra running that I felt like I needed to do, but running across America was something I felt like I needed to do in some format, whether it was going for the record or not. And so why not, you know, do it 30 years early when you're 20, I don't know, 29 years old. And yeah. And so it just kind of worked. The stars kind of aligned my work. They were very supportive. Actually, I've still worked for the same company. And
do they get it?
Yeah. Oh, totally. I work for a company of, you know, like less than 500 employees. And, you know, there was a time where there were like, I think three or four of us that had done 100 mile ultras. And so it was just kind of cool. Like we've always had a very strong running community at my workplace. So yeah, it was just, they, you know, I said, well, I'm going for the record, so I'm not going to be gone that long. And so it was, I think I was, yeah, I mean, it took, you know, 6 weeks. So I think I took 7 weeks absence from work. And then that's all I needed.
And did you break down in advance the splits you were needing? And were you always confident that you could achieve them?
I think I was for the, you know, first day or two, I went out kind of at a blistering pace. And I think I found early on, I was scared, but I was also like trying to not to block out the fact that I had like a giant lump on my inside of my like ankle. And then just all these things that were happening with fatigue and anterior tibular tendonitis. And then, you know, even taking a day off on day seven in the middle of nowhere in Nevada, I thought maybe it was over. And I think, you know, there was just enough, I had gotten over just enough mountains by that point where I think, thankfully, Utah, you know, we had, I think, one big mountain pass in Utah. But I think just that climbing, I wasn't ready for. And so, there was, I would say the first 2 weeks, it didn't really feel good in the Western states. But then in Eastern Utah, I remember on day 14, you know, I was doing, you know, 10 minute pace, you know, the first 2 days I was doing probably 8:39 minute pace, you know, clipping off of miles nice and easy. But then Yosemite was day three, and that was just a mess of up and down roller coaster. And, you know, Yosemite about broke me completely. And, you know, after that, for about 4 days, it was just slower, 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 even on flat, you know, areas of Nevada. But then, you know, another week later, after taking that day off on, I think it was a Sunday, I just remember like I was on flat ground in Utah, and I could have swore I was going downhill, because I was like, I'm holding 9 minute pace, and like, this is good. Like, I don't feel, you know, like I'm in pain anymore. And so, you know, I think it took a while for my body to adjust. But then I think from that day 14 all the way to day, you know, 42 and change, I felt pretty good about my odds.
And what did cause that bump on the ankle? And had you turned it off?
I think it was just all the climbing. You know, I knew coming in, you know, from San Francisco to New York, I think there's somewhere between 100 and 200,000 feet of gain. I can't remember the exact amount, which is not much. I mean, that's like, you know, there's a lot of road marathons that have more gain per mile than that. But I think it was so much of it was concentrated on, you know, 3 days or 3 or 4 days of the whole run, that I think I kind of overlooked the ups and downs. And that just, it was kind of the perfect storm. I started just outside Yosemite National Park on day three, and just, I just didn't comprehend how up and down Yosemite National Park is. But when you're coming from the West, when you're coming from the Valley, and this is the dumb Midwesterner in me, it's a lot of gain. And, you know, I just, I think I was just stubborn because I wanted to hit so many miles those first few days that I was just coming off 2 80-mile days and then another, you know, 73 miles when I really should have just backed it off on that third day. And I think that just about broke me.
Because were you looking at were the splits of the record just looking at how many at the time needed and dividing it, or were you actually looking at the previous attempts splits to then get a sense of how you could potentially what the reality would be?
Yeah, you know, I didn't look too, you know, I knew the whole story of, you know, Frank Giannino, and, you know, he, you know, said hi to, you know, he welcomed me into New York City at the finish. That was the first time I got to meet him. But no, he, you know, for his run in the 80s, you know, obviously ultra running was, you know, when I started in 2011, it was, you know, a fifth the size it is now probably. And when he was doing it, it wasn't even really a thing. It was just, he wanted to run across the U.S. He was a marathon runner who wanted to do this crazy run of, you know, almost 70 miles a day. And his was very up, you know, he picked up the miles a lot as he went on in his run. Mm. And I didn't, you know, I didn't really necessarily want to bank miles early, but I think for whatever reason, I thought, well, if I'm fresh the first day or two, maybe I'll just, you know, add a little extra oomph to the start. You know, and the clock never stops. So like, you know, if you wanted to theoretically just not get any sleep, which would be impossible because you'd have to recover, you know, you could just keep moving the whole time. But, for me, I found recovery very important. So I tried to get the miles done in a reasonable time each day, trying to click off, you know, 9 minute miles, which was, you know, pretty good pace, and, you know, be done in under 14 hours every day.
And what would those 8 hours look like? The 10 hours look like that you weren't running? Because 10 hours it's a decent chunk of time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, it was nice because every day, we never had to stake out, you know, literally we didn't, you know, literally put a stake in the ground where you finish the day and then, you know, drive to a motel or hotel. I stayed in the RV every night, and we were parked right along the road every night. And so that was just great from an efficiency standpoint. Because for me, I think every night I had to I think my heart rate would just take, especially when it was in the desert, it would just take forever for my heart rate to go back down to, you know, a very calm. And I think part of it was too, is just the mental intensity of being out there all day. You're just giving everything you have every single day. And so I think I just had to have at least, you know, an hour, hour and a half to just put my feet up and, you know, eat a ton of calories while I'm not running. So I think that really helped a lot, was having that, you know, a lot of people that do a lot of, you know, like Appalachian Trail or some of these, you know, month long plus endurance feats, they might only be off their feet for about 7 or 8 hours, but that just wasn't the way I operated. Like for me, it was just get it done with each day. You know, you don't have to run extremely fast, but you have to be very efficient, get it done. And then, you know, have that, even if it's only like a half hour, you know, sitting down in the RV just before you go to bed, like just be able to chit chat, you know, with your crew. And I think that was another big thing. You know, I was pretty quiet, you know, during the day. And I don't think I was too bossy, but I think, you know, when you're doing this, you're just like, you, when every time you see your crew, you're just like, I need this, I need this, I need this. And then, you know, it kind of feels good when you can just sit down with them at the end of the day. You know, obviously they're prepping for the next day, but at least kind of become a human again for just a little bit and then go to bed.
What are the things you're barking at them that they wouldn't expect you to be? Where, because ideally you wouldn't need to tell them anything. It would be ready, right?
Yeah, no, they'd always have everything. They'd give me options. Yeah, Chuck and Dean were incredible. And, you know, hopefully maybe someday I can get the band back together and we can do it again, because they were top notch. But just, you know, things that come up, like, you know, a car trying, like getting really close to hitting you, or a semi passing a semi and breezing by you about arm's length to your side, you know, some of that stuff would just come back and I'd give, they could tell when I was rattled out there.
And so from day 14 on, you felt record was fine. But if you think about the approach you took, if you changed that start, you didn't have the issues of the ankle, like how much extra do you think is in there?
Oh, it's hard to tell because, you know, when I was doing it, I think there were times in the Midwest where I would say, okay, we're going to, instead of doing 72 miles, we're going to do 77 today. And, you know, I get to the 77 and, you know, I look, you know, look in the mirror and say, no, we're not doing that again tomorrow. And so I don't know. It's hard to tell, like, you know, if the record, you know, I think I did give it pretty much everything. I think it was good and bad that I had that day off early on, because I think had I not kind of screwed up early on, I think maybe I would have made that mistake later on in the run. And so I think if I went back and did it again, you know, I could probably do it, you know, a day or two faster. I don't know if there's a whole, it's just, cause one thing that's intrigued me is, you know, the most miles run by a human in a month. And I think there's a guy that's done the self-transcendence in New York City, and he was at about 77 and change per day. And so, you know, you're going up against that if you're doing, you know, 72, 73 miles a day. So yeah, it's just, there's just not a whole lot of margin for error.
And do you think when people look at the record, the fact that you've done it the way you did, it's almost quite confusing for them if they think, how am I going to try and break this? Because I can't really copy what you've done, because you wouldn't plan to do over miles and then take a day off. And so do you think that's almost led to increase the legend of it?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, well, so, you know, Jenny Hoffman, she actually lives in the Boston area as well. Speaking of, you know, us meeting up there, she just broke the women's record this last fall. I can't remember how many miles she averaged per day, but it was, I mean, obviously very impressive. It was one of the fastest runs across America, male or female. And she had attempted it before and gotten injured, you know, over 80% of the way across. But yeah, she was a little bit more consistent. It's, you know, it's hard to tell. And then, you know, Sandra Villains had the women's record before Jenny. And I would say Sandra was actually also a little bit more conservative out of the start. So yeah, I think, you know, if I had any advice to anyone else, don't go like crazy at the beginning like I did. And I think Frank Giannino, who had the men's record before me, he also, you know, eased into it a bit more. Cause I think it's just inevitably your body has to get used to, you literally have to break your body into it. And it's almost just like, you know, an airplane taking off, you know, once you get done with takeoff, you know, you're kind of on cruise control. Your body's on cruise control for, you know, the rest of the run.
And how are you using caffeine over that period? Cause it's, it obviously loses its potency the more you use it, but still can be a terrific tool. So did you have a strategy going in, or were you using to feel and need?
Yeah, I mean, it was usually a lot in the morning, especially since I would start usually at 3 or 4 in the morning. So I would try to get, for me mentally, it just felt so much better to get the dark hours of running done first. Yeah. And then try to finish, you know, in the light, because it just for safety reasons, also with there being more traffic at night in the dark than in the morning in the dark.
Was that a morning cup of coffee then? Were you literally?
Oh yeah, I think I took like, I still drink this stuff today. It's like V8 energy drink, you know, maybe a slightly healthier than like a Monster or Red Bull. So yeah, no, caffeine is a huge part of that, and then, you know, especially like around the clock.
Did you notice, because I know with, I guess you're not going to have a sugar crash, caffeine crash in the same way, because the your insulin probably be a bit more regulated because you're constantly taking on more carbs. Did you notice during the day that actually having the caffeine then leave your system was making you more tired, or because you were constantly refueling it, it wasn't an issue?
I don't know. I think because I was refueeling so often, it was, not much of an issue. It was, well, and that was the funny thing about that run is I think from a nutrition standpoint, I think I was like, I always joke with people. I'd wake up at, 3 in the morning and like, I'd have to eat some like a protein bar or something. 'Cause my body, it was just like, I had to keep the kitchen never closed. Like this, my stomach never stopped working that whole 42 days because like, if like, I just had to like, there just had to, I had to be processing calories 24/7 that whole run. It was crazy.
Do you think there's like in the future people might take on drips where it's just dripping in nutrition into their bloodstream directly while they sleep?
Probably. We talked about that before, and I just said, no, we're not, I'm not doing that.
And one thing that I'm conscious of time, but you still work full time, and you, I mean, this record is incredible, and a lot of people who I know in your kind of position with your the records you've done, the success you've had, have been full time athletes or have used it to be a full time athlete. Is it been a very conscious decision not to do that? And have there been limitations by it? And do you, let's start with that one.
Yeah, I think so. Just because, I not that I wouldn't want to be, like a full-time athlete. I think for me, I think that would be too much pressure for me. I think, and then it's just, I don't think, I've been lucky enough to be in the sport of ultra running for, 13 years now, almost 13 years. And I don't know. I think it kind of ebbs and flows. I think if you want to be, in the sport that long, like if you want to, I think, there's probably some people who want to be, they want to have a much more traditional, 5 year span where they're really, focused on running. But for me, I think I don't think I'd be very good at that. I think, for me, it's kind of like that nice, it's almost like I need more stress in my life, and then I can go for a run and then like de-stress. And it's like this cycle of, if I didn't have, like a full-time job, it would almost be like, there's a part of me missing. Not that, I wouldn't love to, have, a long time off, to kind of get back to neutral sometimes. But no, I think it's, for me, I just think it's like it provides almost like the structure I need, I think, mentally and just, I always find the time to run, and that's never been an issue. But and it's just I like the challenge too. I think, of having a lot of stuff on your plate, sometimes it becomes a little overwhelming. But I think, for the most part, it's, even if there were, look at a person like Mike Wardian, and I got to share a hotel room with him one weekend at a Hoka event, and he put me to shame because like I thought I was the most, I always talk about efficiency like on this podcast, but efficiency in real life, like with getting things done and then, having million things going on. But like to see that guy and the amount of efficiency he has, I felt like an outdated like piece of machinery.
What was he doing that made you aware that it was that next level?
I mean, I don't know. He'll hop on a call with someone while he's like basically running, and then like he'll be, I don't know. And then he still had time to do stuff. Like we were geeking out on like fantasy football as well. And so it just made me laugh because I knew he had to be efficient with having a family, a full-time job, and like racing around the world, all the time. But I just never imagined that he also had time for like silly stuff. And so I just gave me so much respect for him to see inside the curtain, I guess.
And one thing that I during the time that you're back the first Badwater now, the ultra scene's changed a fair bit because of was the prominence of UTMB and Western states to the rest of the world, and and how that's changed the kind of the money in the sport and the sponsorships. Do you think a runner like yourself, who isn't in the so focused on the big competitions, do you think there will be room for professional athletes who are more doing kind of transcrons, badwaters that are slightly outside that mold? Or do you think that the big races have sucked away that cash?
Yeah. No, I think there always will, because I think there'll always be, you know, there'll always be the biggest races. And I think that's really cool, because I think that's one thing that if I would change about ultra running is just the amount of, I don't know, call it dilution, but just there are just, it almost feels like the only thing that's outpaced participation ultra running is the amount of races out there. And so, I like when they have races that are very like consolidated with competition, but I think when, you know, road ultras gets a lot, there's a lot of cool stuff, I think, with road ultras and fixed time races and, you know, and then like the backyard races and the following of that race has gotten. So I think in some ways it would just take the right amount of exposure, I think. And I'll be honest, you know, watching any running race, you know, just watching the runners run isn't the most fun thing in the world, but I think there are ways to make it more exciting. So
golden trail.
Right. So yeah, I think there is room for, you know, a lot of different, you know, I think if you're a talented ultra runner, it almost doesn't matter what type of, you know, race you do. I think it just matters, you know, how impressive your performance is. You know, if you go out and do, you know, 100 miles on a track, well, you know, if you break a world record, you know, people are gonna want to follow that. So,
are you intrigued in when you see the UTMBs, your Western States? Would you ever completely focus on trying to perform at specifically those races to do well?
I don't think I would. I just don't know. I mean, I hate to say I wouldn't. I just don't think I am the type of runner, but I think just with all the type of running that I do on road and not training on trail. And I love running on trails, but I just don't. I think if I focus exclusively on being a trail runner, I would just keep getting injured because I'm kind of clumsy.
Oh, I see. Because normally people switch to trail because their body can't take the road, but it's actually the falling that's the issue.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and then sometimes you get a really good trail runner who, you know, they get on a road and, you know, they just the repetitiveness, I think, gets them. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's almost like I maybe have like this like weird, you know, like the people at the grocery store that always say they have a bad knee and that's why they don't run anymore. Maybe that's like my excuse with trail running is like, if I trained a bunch on trails, I just keep tripping and then I just get injured and blah, 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 blah.
Well, I think it is a factor. I mean, if you look at someone like Camille Herron, she has such a shuffly style running, technique, which is amazing for efficiency over road, but if you go to trail, it's hard because you've got to pick your feet up more. And so actually sometimes people's gait isn't quite right for it's better for one type of running than another. Well, thank you so much for coming to the podcast, and it was lovely to meet you at the Run Show as well. And you've mentioned this is a big year, potentially some ambitious plans. Are you allowed to mention any of those?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think, you know, since we talked last time, I think I got my last race figured out for the year. I won't even list them off because it's too much. I'll just, you know, we talked about Badwater, hope to do Badwater again, hope to do Leadville and a few other races. But yeah, if I do all the races I'm signed up for right now, you know, it'd be like the most hundreds I've ever done in a year. So 100 or more mile races I've done. So we'll see. I don't know. It's been very motivational for me kind of getting back into the running. So I'm just kind of run.
And which of those ones, of course, we haven't even talked about injury and stuff. And which of those ones kind of excites you or gives you the most fear?
Before I had to take some time off running. I was signed up for Cocodona 250, and that's here in like the beginning of May. And so I think that's like probably easily the most scary thing just because it's so soon. And I'm like, I'm up to 20 miles of a 20 mile run this last weekend, but
yeah, okay.
That's still less than 10% of the race. And so I'm going to come in much less trained than I normally would.
And actually, I'd love to talk off your injury, but I'm conscious of how long we've taken, and I should have got to that sooner. But thanks so much for coming on the podcast, and good luck with the race of May. I hope the mileage does increase before then. And if there's anything we can do to, you know, kind of help you as a community, or if you're ever passing through London, let me know. It'd be lovely to catch up again.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, David. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Pete. My pleasure. And I just realized we didn't even get a chance to post in Instagram or socials that Pete was coming on, because I'm sure there'd be so many questions from the Do-Badders. Apologies. We're just not that organized at the moment because of travel and various other things. But we didn't even go into the fact that Pete's been, he's had a really bad injury. He had a, and we spoke at the run show about that. He had a bad car accident last year, and just how much that's been a challenge to try and come back from. And especially if you think of the miles and the races he does, having that awareness of just how much your body needs to be able to take when you come back from zero. So that's something we maybe chat about at the end of the year or next year, when can see hopefully he's had a great season by then, and we can talk through actually what that was like in terms of his recovery, but also just I guess mentally how it's been as a challenge, and whether the approach to retraining your body has been very different from the first time. You're kind of building from zero, but actually you've got all that different knowledge. But thanks for listening, guys. If you've got any suggestions for future guests, then message me david@badboyrun.com, or you can just message directly through Instagram. And if you enjoyed this episode, other episodes to do with bad water, we've had quite a few episodes on bad water. One of the ones I thought was really interesting was Ashley Paulson. We've interviewed her a couple of times. The first one was, she's a triathlete who did bad water, had an incredible performance. And then the ultra community and Marathon Investigates kind of turned on her, and almost couldn't handle the fact that she'd done so well having come from triathlon. And so we talked about what that felt like to be almost at the center of a hate campaign, where there were some fairly senior people in the ultra community that seemed to be backing Derek against her. I mean, Derek came out and said there's no reason to doubt her performances. And the next year she went back and smashed the record, and we interviewed her after that. So that was a really interesting one, a really good one. We've spoken to Harvey Lewis a couple of times. I think that was about bad water as well, and a little bit about the backyards. He's won both of those in the past. And the Race Across America, talking about that, we spoke to Chris Finnell, who he's done that previously, but also he's one of the, are they called the Eternals, or... he's run every single London Marathon, and he talks about both of those things. But the London Marathon side of things was really interesting, because it's such a joyful thing to be part of that community, where each year they have this reunion. And but also there's the reality of it, when there's fewer people that turn up each time, and the pressure that has on you that you have to turn up. He's broken his arm in one marathon in one London. And he's also got, I think, the record for the most number of like sub-3s or sub-3:15s back-to-back-to-back in London. Just really, really interesting. So that's just it, guys. As I say, any suggestions of future guests, let me know. Do please subscribe, rate and review. Get in the group to ask, to get involved in the conversation, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye-bye-bye-bye. Bye-bye-bye-bye-bye.
Admit I was a clown to be messing around, but that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Come back, yes, and give me one more try, 'cause a love like this should
Fuck you, buddy.